I remember the first conversation that I had with somebody suffering from post-concussion syndrome. It was a 14-year-old female who was playing basketball a couple weeks ago and went up for a rebound and got elbowed in the head accidentally by an opposing player. She had a little bit of a headache, but the next day, she could not tolerate light, could not focus. The next 2 weeks up to the point that she saw me were a bit of a living hell for her, for a 14-year-old, not to be able to look at light, to interact with her friends, to not focus, and just to be excluded from school because she had to. That was traumatizing. That was a hard story to hear. Our guest on this podcast is trying to really break down the barriers that science has on concussions because we just don't know much. Our guest was Jess Schwartz, and she's doing some really, really cool stuff and trying to figure out concussions. So we asked her a lot of questions because we didn't know. And I think that's a pretty common thing. So I hope you enjoyed this podcast. I hope you learned something. And please shoot us your questions for at Therapy Insiders and at DPT2Go, which is Jess. And now, a word from our sponsor, WebPT. We are proud to be sponsored by WebPT, the end-to-end business solution for private practice PTs, OTs, and SLPs, providing everything from documentation and scheduling to RCM service, billing software, and outcome tracking. WebPT's mission is to help rehab therapists achieve greatness in practice, and that starts with education. That's why WebPT is offering a free guide to healthcare payment reform. To download it today, visit webpt.com/pay-for-performance. And now, on to Therapy Insiders. Hello, welcome back to Therapy Insiders. Dr. Gene Shirokabrad here with Dr. Joe Palmer, Dr. Erson Religioso. Gentlemen, how goes it?
Good, Gene.
It's going well, Gene.
Excellent. I don't think you guys have ever said anything else except for that. Like, you've never said, man, I am having a pretty crappy day, or I am so ecstatic. You guys are always good. Having a good day.
Got to stick to the script here, Gene.
The irony is that we've never, ever, ever had anything, even a semblance of a script.
No, I mean, ironic. I think the closest thing is when I actually read someone's bio off of their webpage.
Yeah, I think that's probably about as prepared as we get for this. But that's our style, the spontaneity, the conversation. And we just don't have time. Honestly, we just don't have time to prepare. Let's be honest here. We just don't have time for that. We just off the cuff and go with it. And so a lot has happened over the last few weeks. We've talked a whole bunch of stuff. We've got some really cool guests coming up in future podcasts that we scheduled that I'm really excited about, as well as our guest today. But we were at CSM several weeks ago, month and a half ago or something like that. And I got to hang out with a lot of cool people and interact with some people that we see on Twitter and just haven't met in person. And CSM also allowed for the opportunity to talk different and new things coming up in the world. So our friends at EIM and John Childs, Larry Benz are doing a lot of cool stuff. And one of the things that I saw that's happening that's I think it is really important for the world of physical therapy and for the world in general, and you guys definitely let me know what you think, is concussions. And I think it's growing, it's evolving, and obviously with the NFL, all that stuff going on, there's been so much out there. But I feel like it's still such a new and ever-growing field that it was really cool to hear EIM stepping up and partnering with our guest today. And We'll let Urson introduce her. But what do you guys think about concussions before we bring on our expert?
Gene, I think that you're right. There's definitely a knowledge gap that we need to fill, and I think that physical therapists are poised to be a big player in that realm. I'm excited to chat with our guest today because she knows a lot more about it than I do.
Probably all of us combined. What about you, Urs? What do you think? And then you can lead into the introduction.
Yeah, that's probably true. I mean, I treat a lot of headache patients, TMD patients, basically a lot of cervical. I mean, at some point, for at least 8 years of my career, I was treating 90% basically headache and TMD patients. And every once in a while, almost like your chronic whiplash patient, I would get a concussion patient in, or a patient who had all those things plus a concussion. And I would just think to myself, in the way that I always thought, yeah, I got this. And, you know, I would fail miserably, or they just wouldn't respond like I thought they would. And conversely, I've been referred patients who had concussions and from other physical therapists or neurologists. And it turns out that there was just a strong cervical component that was missed because they weren't physical therapists. So I think bridging that knowledge gap and you know, knowing when to refer out, or you know, using a multidisciplinary approach, I think that's key. And you know, I think it's really important, again, like I always preach, you just have to know your weaknesses and know when you need to you know, do what's best for the patient and potentially send them on to someone else. So, you know, I've been excited to talk to our guest, Dr. Jessica Schwartz, for a while now. I mean, I think, was it maybe a year or two ago where I had you do a guest blog for me, and then basically EIM basically took the blog too, and it just kind of exploded? Was that, how many years ago was that now? Is that 1 year, 2 years?
I don't think I did a blog for you, Urson.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I know EIM took the adapt.
Yet another failed introduction.
I am not editing that out.
That's okay. No, EIM definitely took the Choosing Wisely campaign that I wrote. I basically rewrote the Choosing Wisely campaign for the American Physical Therapy Association very politely. And I educated folks on, you know, I found fault with the Choosing Wisely campaign solely from a language perspective of positive language use. So I actually rewrote the Choosing Wisely campaign almost exactly of what they had, just in different language. And I sincerely believe that most people from cross-disciplinary clinicians to patients have no idea our capability of what we can do to help them. So I said it was ridiculous that we told them five things that we shouldn't be doing for them, when most folks don't know what we can be doing for them as physical therapists.
Let's get into the concussion thing, obviously. Let's get that done first, because obviously that's what you're spending most of your professional career on at this point. And you partner with EIM, you got this awesome program in development, which we'll talk about. But what is a concussion? What is a concussion, and what is the latest research on it?
Great question. So what we know today is that there are actually over 43 working definitions of a concussion.
You would think, how many definitions?
That's right. Yeah, over 43. And quite frankly, I've heard different numbers, but that's the number that I consistently stick with, because the NCAA Department of Defense has been using that definition. There are over 43 working definitions of concussion, and only one of them is evidence-based. So if we're even talking about from a definition from a research perspective, you know, just in research and traumatic brain injury in general, there's actually not been one phase 3 clinical trial in traumatic brain injury research that's actually gone to phase 3, come to fruition from phase 3. Because I sincerely believe part of this is because the injury is so heterogeneous. And then two, we don't have a definition for concussion or TBI. And we know that concussion falls in the mild traumatic brain injury definition for now. But right now, we're still working in the world of concussion definitions. So, but yeah, happy to break down any questions you guys have.
Well, I would say, I'm curious, actually, before you go into the working research-based definition or evidence-based definition, What is the worst definition of concussion you've ever heard, then, if you've heard at least 40?
Oh, man. The worst. You know, I still, to this day, you know, and it's part of it's our fault. You know, we've enabled a culture that just didn't address concussion in the medical world. And so my least favorite thing today, and, you know, I hear it all the time, is I got my bell rung, or that patient got their bell rung. Because we know that, you know, it is a much more complex injury than what that phrase gives the, you know, denotes. So I think that's still my least favorite.
And then what is the current evidence? What is the definition according to the evidence, I should say?
Well, there's a few things that I'll put in there. I think some misnomers that folks, you know, think that you have to get hit in the head to have a concussion. And some of the latest work that's coming out right now is that we're really focusing also not just on the head injuries. And remember that head injuries involve linear and rotational injuries. And then we also are getting into a lot of research here, and this you can kind of even learn from the concussion movie if you're in the lay public and just going to the movie theaters these days. It's actually something called a subconcussive blow. So we're actually seeing that any kind of jolt or blow to the body and or head and neck amounts over time. So we're not looking at a lot of these things as an event, but more of a process. So I think that's a huge misnomer. And I think that once people think of it like that, it becomes a whole different animal in terms of, you know, comprehending clinically and kind of moving forward from there.
How much of concussions is, or post-concussive syndrome, how much of it is purely biomechanical, like there's a traumatic brain injury, versus biopsychosocial? Like, people can have a concussion and recover fairly quickly versus somebody else can take months to years to have these symptoms. What goes into a recovery process between one person versus another?
That's probably one of the best questions I've actually ever received. So I think if we kind of piecemeal, I call patients people. I think if we piecemeal people apart like that, it's almost can be a disservice. So I think if we're almost thinking of a biopsychosocial component with anything, with any person, with any patient that we're treating, I think we almost can't take that away from the actual event. So what I do is I educate on mechanism of injury is really important. And if we look at things from like a pain science perspective, you know, was that injury stressful? Was that a car accident? Was this from a domestic abuse or a trauma? Or was this from a quote unquote simple blow to the head from a soccer header that just went awry? So there's so many factors that play into pre-morbid history. Like, how did the injury happen, the mechanism of injury? And then what's also the pre-morbid history and post-morbid issues that are happening with the patient? So biopsychosocial is a huge component on how we address things. And quite frankly, you know, 0 days to 3 months out, you're a completely different animal than someone that's 3 months out to 12 months out that's now suffering from a post-concussive syndrome or the persistent symptoms of post-concussive, you know, injuries. So that's a fantastic question, but the biopsychosocial component is huge. And when I educate folks, I actually have them go through the therapeutic neuroscience education from Dr. Adrian Lowe, because, you know, there's potential. Not all concussions, and I make this really clear, you know, good chunk, up to 80%, are recovering within, I would say, I think the old model is 7 to 10 days. I think we're looking at it more now of like a 3 to 4 week recovery pathway. And we can talk about that as well. I think if we're looking down at the pre-morbid history of these patients, you have to look for any yellow and red flags, just as if we're looking at a low back pain patient, like a typical MSK patient, you know, or anything else, especially if it's like a whiplash-associated disorder. I think there's a lot of carryover there with chronic pain.
Jess, does all that variability, lead to the difficulty of assessment and then treatment and coming up with some kind of clinical guidelines? You got 43 definitions of a concussion and they all present a little different and you're seeing them at different periods of time, different mechanisms of injury. That can be overwhelming for a clinician, can it?
Yeah, that's 100% accurate, and overwhelming, I think, is a perfect word for it. And I also say you have all of those different mechanisms of injury, and the presentation is so heterogeneous. And also think about, like, if we have a low back pain patient, most folks are going to come to physical therapy or potentially see their primary care practitioner or an orthopedist and so on. And I think of, like, a cancer patient. Cancer patients go to an oncologist. Boom. Cancer is complicated. We go see that one clinician. But with concussion, you have access portals to anyone at any time at any given point of your recovery. So, for example, you know, you have your athletic trainer, your physical therapist, your primary care practitioner, a pediatrician, if your emergency department and urgent care, and the list goes on through neurology and so on. So it's tough because you don't know where you're necessarily accessing these patients, you know, in the point of their recovery. Is this super acute? Is this subacute? Is this more of a chronic stage? So there's so many things that you have to really become comfortable when working with these patients in terms of presentation as well.
Right, and then figuring out what is appropriate for that stage so that you're making the appropriate assessment and then potential referral if you need to get them to somewhere else, right?
Absolutely. And I think that's, you know, knowing that one's own limitations, except I think we kind of missed the mark. And this isn't just from a neurological perspective in the neurology community. You know, I always say, and I think this humbles people, but, you know, 2015 was actually the first formal didactic year that neurology physicians, so brain doctors, right, had formal didactic education for residency in concussion. So I think when that we put that kind of that into frame and context, I think that really puts us all on the same grounds, you know, same floor here. And how can we work together then to kind of move forward in our approach with these patients? Because it really can become such a sensitive nature if you are the one delivering the information of, oh, okay, you may not be able to go to work because you're having these symptoms. You may be losing your job or custody of your children or marriage may be failing because of personality issues. You know, and the list goes on, especially when we're talking with our athletes about sport. You know, this is what they love. So now you're taking something away from them. That's their everything. So it really is quite a pervasive injury.
Let me ask you about the mechanism. And here, let me paint the scenario. So typically when you say concussions, most people, I'm guessing, think football and head injuries. Mm-hmm. So when I played football in high school, God knows I got destroyed many a times and vice versa. And I remember the first time when I stepped on the field, I was the gunner on the kickoff team. And I remember running and just going after the guy and then flipping and everything's black and white. And I remember standing up just thrilled that all my limbs were attached to me and it was all good from there. But there was never a moment where I felt knocked out or, like you said, the bell rung. And then you know, I see moments, like, for example, my almost 4-year-old son would just run into something and hit his head with no mm-hmm. ill effect. But then I hear a story of a girl getting hit with a basketball and she has a concussion and she has severe post-concussion syndrome symptoms. Is there a known mechanism that can cause a concussion, the force required, the place in the head to get hit? Does there need to be whiplash symptoms? Like, is there any kind of conclusive or even non-conclusive evidence that's starting to correlate with what can cause a concussion?
Well, what we know, neurophysiologically at least, is we're getting from animal models. So Chris Giza out of UCLA is a wonderful physician, and he actually put together a wonderful example of the neurometabolic cascade. And I can send you that article if you want to post that in the show notes for the readers and the listeners. Essentially, we know that, you know, concussion is a physiology, it's an injury of physiology and energy utility. And, you know, anything that stresses the brain, depending on where you are in your development, where you are in your life, have you had, you know, 5,000 subconcussive blows before? So, for example, and this is exactly where we're getting into a little bit of difficulty with some of the research that's going on out there. And I'll give you the example of head sensors. So you can get, you know, 120G linear force, boom, right to the head. It can get recorded in a helmet. It can get recorded in a head sensor if you're wearing a headband. And that athlete may look completely fine. Then again, you can also get a 15G or 30G rotational injury to the head, and that person is completely knocked out and unconscious.
Now, when you say rotational, what do you mean, rotational G?
So like rotational force to the head. So we're not, you know, when we have injuries, you know, I always use an example of a car accident. Nothing is ever, you know, straight on. If you've ever worked with a patient's living with amputee patients, you know, that cut is never straight down. There's always some kind of rigidity or jaggedness or it's nothing's ever straight. So the same thing happens with injury. You don't just get hit straight on. It's often a rotational component. So you'll see a lot of the, you know, if we're just thinking about the NFL, those injuries, those guys are like flying in the air if they're caught targeting and their heads get whipped around. That's a rotational and linear injury together. So those combination platter and or just solely rotational injuries are a little bit more quote unquote serious than a straight on just linear force. So we're having difficulties because we're just looking at data on a screen. You're seeing 120 G force and you're seeing a 30 G force. And that person laying on the field or the sideline is knocked unconscious from a 30 G force. It's very confusing. So a lot of folks don't realize that a lot of these injuries are very benign looking. It's a soccer header. It's a MVA without the airbag going off. It's someone getting, you know, standing up at work and bumping their head into a shelf. You know, it's very interesting on how these present. And the severity really doesn't have anything to do with force a lot of the time.
So when you say rotational, do you mean multi-planar or like the force is absorbed in more than one plane as opposed to your traditional kind of acceleration, deceleration, anterior to posterior? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, essentially. So, you know, almost like if you're thinking from a vestibular component, head on body, body on head, is the person flying through the air and they're like rotating and then they get hit and then their head gets whipped around? If they're standing stationary and they get hit in the head with a soccer ball, boom, right through the frontal lobe area, that's a different issue. We're also, and just to throw another, you know, wrench in the bucket here, is that we're also seeing folks that are getting hit in temporal lobe actually tend to have a little bit more persistent symptomatology. And I think that's been very interesting. I've been seeing it for years in clinic and on presentation, and we're actually starting to see it in the literature now. So that's why the head, you know, removing heading for kids that are 13 and under was such a big deal.
I would agree with that clinically. I found that the majority of the patients who I found with concussions plus whiplash associated disorders, you know, like the chronic kind of CVA that Gwen Jull has kind of identified that is difficult for everyone in the world to treat, even like a, you know, evidence-based multidisciplinary team. I found that they were usually in a car and looking at someone because they knew, like, they were looking at a child or looking at they're worried about someone or reaching for something. And it wasn't just like a kind of head-on thing. I found that those are the most difficult cases.
Yeah, and I would concur. And, you know, even for myself, I was not looking, I was not prepared. So we also think about it as a preparedness as well. You know, we can talk C-spine all day, right, Erson? But, you know, not to get you too excited, but, you know, if we're just thinking from a C-spine component, you know, in terms of musculature, you know, if you're not prepared for a hit, you know, then you're just like a bobblehead, you know, and anything can happen. And we know those CO to C3 afferents in that trigeminal nucleus, you know, boom, can get a lot of is so important to how we function. So,
when you say you weren't prepared, did you have a concussion?
Yeah, so that's actually the impetus for me kind of being in this space. I was actually in a car accident in 2013. Stopped here at a red light on 12th Street and 5th Avenue. Beautiful day. I just rode 52 miles the day before on my bicycle, you know, in New York City safely. And I'm at a red light, about to plug in my iPhone, looking down, didn't see it coming, and I got hit by an unlicensed driver behind me. And what we know is that dizziness is one of the is one of the symptoms that we see that can relate to persistent symptoms later on in life. And as soon as I got out of the car, like a true New Yorker I am, I was about to give the guy the business. And I'm like, are you kidding me? You know, it's like a noon on a Thursday.
With a little bit more colorful language than are you kidding me?
Yeah, the hands were going, you know, who knows. But, you know, I fell right over. I grabbed onto the hood of my car and I sat back down and I said, okay, fair enough. I was like, let me just take a breath. And again, airbags didn't go off, didn't think anything much of it, did go to the ED, you know, got my CAT scanned, you know, Varsity Blues, reference there, but I did. I never thought I could be as sick as I was, and I endured about 10 to 14 hours of rehab a week for a year, for 14 months actually, until I got back on my feet. So,
wow. So what were you going through those 10 to 14 months? Like what was happening, if you don't mind sharing?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I really sincerely believe in sharing my story. And actually, the Brain Injury Association just reached out to me this week, and I just signed the contract so I can talk about it. But I'll actually be the keynote speaker at the Brain Injury Association annual meeting in New York on June 10th.
Wow, so that's cool. Really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, I was very honored to get that invite. But and it's also Brain Injury Awareness Month. So this is perfect that we're doing this podcast now. So the hashtag for Brain Injury Awareness Month is Not Alone in Brain Injury. So if you're a supporter of that, you know, I encourage people to share their tweets and their social media. Essentially, for me, my primary were ocular motor issues, convergence insufficiency, vestibular issues, and I had some short-term memory deficits that I really had to overcome, and some, you know, balance issues that, you know, correlated with the vestibular and migraines.
What is convergence insufficiency?
Surely. So if we're speaking to a group of physios here, I always say, you know, imagine if you're trying to walk straight and your right leg wants to go one way and your left leg wants to go the other. Essentially, my left, you're not going to get too far, right? So my left eye was having trouble converging. So essentially my eyes weren't working well together. So I was having multiple headaches from different pathways. So like light sensitivity was a big one for me and still is. So you'll usually see me with sunglasses if I don't know in a new environment. I don't like LED overhead lighting at all, still to this day. And I was having ocular motor issues. So like I was getting headaches because I actually couldn't read for 6 months. I was having oscillopsia. So I felt like, you know, I knew what it was to take like, you know, like LSD from the 70s, because the words on paper was just, you know, just moving around. And it was a completely frightening event.
Minus the fun trips that I hear happens with LSD.
Yeah, the stuff I see in the movies. I never saw any kind of cool rainbows and moving stuff like that. But yeah, I couldn't read, which, you know, I read about 20 plus medical journals a month before I got hit. So, you know, reading and, you know, being connected to our profession that I know all of us love so much was pretty devastating for me when I was going through the recovery.
Did you have any ocular issues before or any head injuries before? Like anything that could have led to you being predisposed to the trauma?
Surely. Yeah. So I had a few things. I had about 6 to 7 documented concussions, you know, throughout my career. So I played 4 sports in high school, and then I was recruited to play basketball in college, and then I got injured. So I ended up coaching in college, and I was a NCAA coach by the time I was 21, which was pretty cool. So I won my first game coaching as a young buck. So I had some predisposition there. Also, I speak publicly. I had a learning disability. I still do. I just learn differently. So that's also kind of a yellow red flag, that potentially had some, you know, who knows where I learned now that there are potential ocular motor issues with folks with learning disabilities. But, I never had anything else that would predispose me, otherwise.
Well, so you went through this long period, and obviously it sounds like it was a cumulative effect from everything that leading up to it, and which is to the point where you were making earlier, that kind of that's an important factor. Everything that's happened before could obviously lead in the summation of events like you. So you went through this entire period of rehab, and you are where you are now. Obviously, you're a physical therapist, and this is your world to study it. Do you still have any kind of hesitations, not just symptoms, but anything that, not necessarily post-traumatic stress, but things that you are hesitant of since then that you might have not been before?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I protect my noggin like you wouldn't believe. So, and I think most folks that have kind of gone through what I have. So, you know, it hurts my heart a little bit when I see folks writing about the hypochondriac, you know, post-concussive syndrome patient. But, you know, when you've gone through something like this, that's as devastating as this is, it changes your whole being. So, you know, folks going from super social, outgoing, talkative, intelligent, you can name all of these positive attributes, becoming complete recluse, not wanting to be out in social settings because, you know, simple things make, you know, it's like turning your head to the right can make you so sick for hours. So I protect my head for sure. And I was just moderating at Georgetown Med last weekend. It's actually the first international summit on female concussion and traumatic brain injury. And I did. I was moderating Chris Nowinski, who I know publicly speaks about his concussions, and he runs the Concussion Legacy Foundation, where all the brains get sent for CTE. And quite frankly, I said, you know, who's in this audience? And I asked about physicians and PTs and so on. And I said, you know, who's had a concussion before? I would say about half the audience raised their hand. Including, you know, most of them are clinicians in that audience. And then I asked the question, and I think it made the room go silent. I said, who still has residual deficits from that concussion? And people, about a quarter of those people raised their hand, which amounted to about 60 to 80 people, I'd say, from a quick scan, which was really powerful. Because I think we're a lot of folks in a lot of clinics and things like that, oh, we can cure concussion and all this stuff. And, you know, I don't really think we're asking the right questions to know what recovery really means. So I think that's going to be part of the future of being, you know, good clinicians.
Before continuing with Jessica with more awesome information on concussions, let's take a little break and hear a word from our sponsor, WebPT. As you know, WebPT is the ultimate EMR, but WebPT also provides incredible content. Every month, WebPT provides a free webinar to help providers learn more and educate on being better in practice and business. This month, I sat down with Dr. Heidi Janenga, the co-founder and president of WebPT, to learn more. And I asked Heidi, what will people learn if they tune in to this webinar?
Well, Gene, with each passing day, we're moving closer to a completely value-based healthcare paradigm, one in which payers will financially incentivize providers based on their patients' outcomes, not just the volume of services provided to those patients. Soon, it won't be possible to provide subpar therapy and still turn a profit. In fact, it'll be difficult to make any money at all without providing valuable treatment and collecting objective data that backs up the effectiveness of that treatment. And once that data's in, we're all going to know who's performing at the top of his or her game and who isn't. So how do you ensure you and your practice make the cut? You start by tracking outcomes data, and you start right now. To learn more about payment reform and how outcomes factors into it, download our free guide at webpt.com/payforperformance. That's webpt.com/payforperformance, all one word.
Thanks, Heidi. Definitely check out webpt.com/payforperformance. And now let's get back to Therapy Insiders with Jessica Schwartz and learn a little bit more about concussions.
You talk about post-recovery and recovery in general, and you know a lot of the sports research I've been reading has been trying to identify baselines, probably before injury, and then you know comparative things that we can measure objectively after injury to see if someone's suffering from post-concussive syndrome. Can you talk about that for our clinician audience that might be you know PTs or ATs? That, you know, how to identify this with tools that we could use clinically?
Surely. So in terms of baseline testing, two points that I'm going to make, which I think are going to be more valuable than most of the things that you're going to read out there, quite frankly, in the literature. One being that you have to take an exquisite history on these patients. So you really have to understand the pre-morbid person that is coming into your office. So you have to understand those pre-morbid conditions that potentially can decompensate on you. For example, the ADHD, the learning disabilities, the sleep apnea or sleep disorders, the strabismus and ocular motor issues, mood, orthopedic issues, you know, dyspnea and things like that. A lot of folks don't realize that you can get sleep apnea after this if you get hit in the head and face. So the pre-morbid, you know, decompensation is number one. And that's going to tie in directly to baseline in a second. The second thing is that I think we think of this injury as solely a central nervous system injury, and it's not. We have to remember that it's both a central and a peripheral nervous system injury, and they both are producing symptoms at the same time. So, I mean, honestly, you may as well, if you don't want to be in this game, in this concussion game, just throw up the papers and walk away, because there's so much to kind of look out and piece together when we're looking at these patients. So if we go with those two central tenets of remembering it's both a central and a peripheral injury quite often, And that, you know, we have to remember the decompensated premorbid history that it has the potential to happen after these injuries. We have some things that are great for physios, and quite frankly, everyone's using them. So I'm a really big fan of the King-Devick test. I think the King-Devick test does wonderful work. And if you haven't checked it out, it's King, K-I-N-G, new word, Devick, named after Steve Devick. He's actually an optometrist. Does wonderful work, and actually it's the only thing, quite frankly, that the Mayo Clinic has ever endorsed. So if you actually go on the Mayo Clinic homepage, you'll actually see the King-Devick test. It's called the KD. I think the SCAT-3, I think, is good enough for right now. A lot of people are even using the SCAT-2. There is a SCAT-3 out there right now that kind of breaks down some information from a SAC, a standard assessment concussion score, does some memory things, some balance, like the BEST is involved in there. So I think those are your two best bets in terms of and there's also some cognitive testing. For example, I don't endorse it, but it's the number one thing out there, and the NCAA and DOD are also using it in their pre-testing, is impact testing. One thing that I make very, very clear is that there is no test that outperforms a good clinician, and that there is no single test that can diagnose a concussion. So this is often, this is not often, it's 100% a clinical diagnosis. But to have a baseline, you know, comprehension or understanding of your patients is nice, but quite frankly, it's not often that we get that, especially when we're seeing the number one cause of TBI or falls. And the sports-related concussion is really not the biggest numbers that we're seeing out there.
So if a clinician gets a patient, right, and just kind of going back to the feel of it, because like you said, nothing beats a good clinician. A good clinician is somebody that can build a solid relationship really quickly with the person in front of them. So if a clinician is trying to connect, let's say a 14-year-old patient, basketball player, gets hit in the head from a rebound and is having post-concussive syndrome symptoms, what would you say to them based on what you went through to connect with the person? So what is that 14-year-old going through if it's similar to what you went through, and what can they do to obviously make it better or make them understand or just connect emotionally?
Yeah, that's another great question. You know, quite frankly, I bring a lot of the therapeutic neuroscience education and just basic rapport 101 skills. A lot of these patients, whether they're a 14-year-old patient who may have, you know, difficulty communicating and is a little shyer, or, you know, an adult, a lot of these folks are really going through the ringer. They're being told that they're malingerers, or they're making things up, or they're being told to rest for like 14 months. Guys, I cannot tell you the stories of just the horrendous stories of mismanagement that I've heard. And I'm completely serious. And we're looking at folks that are, you know, from, you know, a lower socioeconomic situation to pro athletes. And I really talk about the pro athletes only because if we think of these men and women, they have access to the best of the best, and these guys are getting mismanaged. So really being able to listen to your patients, listen to their story, listen to their history, connect with them there, validate their symptom profile, very big. These folks do not want to tell a lot of times their primary care practitioners who are listening to them that, hey, I feel like I have a fishbowl over my head when I go into the supermarket, or hey, I feel like my eyes are jumping around, or hey, I feel like I'm having outer body experiences. You sincerely feel like you're a crazy human when you're saying these things, and also when you're listening to these things. If we don't know what's going on, we still have to listen to them, take it in, acknowledge it. Don't ever make them feel poorly about what's going on with them, because I say most folks, pediatric or adult, do not have the subjective language to explain what they're feeling post-concussion. Period, bottom line. They don't know how to explain what a migraine feels like. They don't know how to explain what ocular motor issues feel like. My subjective history for my eye issues as a clinician who ran four concussion clinics, my eyes, I said, I feel like an albino. I like my eyes just won't sit still. But when you looked at me, my eyes weren't moving around. But I couldn't fixate on a target that was directly in front of me. So I had a head tilt. So really building that rapport. So I say, you know, if I had an urson treating me, you know, honestly, a lot of folks are fantastic clinicians, but your environment may not set you up for success with your patient. So you also have to be paying attention to your clinic, your lighting, your music. You know, you might not want to have a concussion patient that's pretty lit up coming in, you know, at 4 to 6 o'clock when you're treating your athletes. So, you know, there's so many things, but really just building trust and rapport. If you build trust and rapport with any kind of persistent concussion or post-concussive syndrome patient, you will actually have them for life. And that's the consistent information that we're seeing out there, is that I have about 10 to 15 people a week internationally reach out to me who have post-concussive syndrome, who are just looking for help and someone to validate their symptom profile. And I can't tell you, these folks find one person and they stick to them. So if you can do that, I mean, you'll have patient for life.
If you want such a thing.
That's true.
I just wanted to go back to what you're talking about, developing rapport. And I think that one of the easiest ways not to be able to do that is to start thinking that the patient isn't really feeling what they're feeling. And I think that I've fallen into it before, and I think that it goes back to some of the myths that you're trying to dispel and helping us learn about tonight. It doesn't matter exactly how much force, right, it was there. You can't just look at the mechanism and say, you know, that the patient shouldn't be feeling what they're feeling. And I think that when you go in with a more open mind, I think that helps you to understand and be that provider that can listen and can help at least talk to them about their symptoms and acknowledge that everything they're feeling is appropriate for post-concussive.
Yeah, Joe, that's spot on. And I if you were here, I'd give you a high five and a chest bump, you know, just because it's spot on. And these folks are just feeling lost. And what's happening is that most folks are just feeling disconnected to the healthcare community. So I actually make all of my patients, not my patients, although my students may be patients by the time I'm done with them after this year course. I have all my students actually listen to a wonderful opening plenary from the International College of Residency Education conference from 2014, delivered by Dr. Lorelei Lingard. And it's actually free open access. I'll shoot you guys the YouTube link to put in your show notes as well. But she actually talks about collective competency in healthcare. And we actually know that from her research, she's actually researched language from physicians. And we actually know that, we all know that our patients are going through a maze of disconnected care episodes as we're becoming all specialists and specialized in something. But we also know that individual competence does not equal good healthcare. And I really connect that with concussion patients. Like, you just can't treat the headache, or you just can't treat the balance or vestibular disorder or the cognitive issues. It really has to be piecemeal together. And I kind of use the example of baking a cake. You know, you can't just whip up the eggs on Monday and add the flour on Tuesday. So this really becomes a team collaborative approach. So, you know, with folks in the orthopedic industry, I always say, you know, I did my residency in ortho at NYU in 2010. And these folks are in constant cognitive bombardment. Like, honestly, think about your day and what you do that does not involve your brain. Now, think about an ankle patient that comes through your door and you take them into potential partial or non-weight bearing for a few days, and then you kind of gradually increase them into what they're doing in their day. We don't really understand that. It's such an abstract concept of physical, and physical rest we kind of get. Cognitive rest, nobody knows what that means. These patients just have, they just require a lot of care and skill. Really, number one thing you can do for these folks is listen to them and see if you can guide them in an appropriate way.
That's awesome. And I think that's a prevailing thought that's going through healthcare in general, is patient-centered and focusing on them and listening. Shut your mouth and listen to them. I mean, the crazy statistic, I think, is on average, clinician, I think it's MDs, let a patient talk for like 10 or 12 seconds before they interrupt, which is insane to me. Whether you're a clinician or you're in business or you're structuring any kind of deal, the last thing you want to do is speak that soon when somebody else is talking, because that just disrupts the whole flow of conversation. And I think that goes with your thought, Jess. So I feel like I learned a ton today about concussions, and I know I would love to learn more. But thanks so much for joining us today, and we'll have to have you back for part two of this thing.
Yeah, I'd love to have, you know, I'd love to be on here for part two. And I just thank you guys so much. Yeah, I'd love to talk. We can break it down any which way you want, from the concussion movie to, you know, we have the new Ivy League tackle rules that are probably going to go through in June. So that might be a fun time to revisit this. They're going to be removing tackling from all Ivy League football practices. Wow. So we can go on for days. Yeah, we can go on for days and days. So it takes the Ivy League a little smarter than the rest probably to realize the pervasiveness of this injury.
It took them long enough. Fantastic. So where can our listeners find you? Tell them about the program that you've partnered with the IM with, if they're interested in concussions, and then we'll put everything else into the updocmedia.com show notes for Therapy Insiders.
Awesome. So I can be found on Twitter. I'm pretty active on Twitter professionally at DPT2Go, like Dr. Physical Therapy, the number 2Go. I can also be found on my blog at pt2go.co, not a .com, .co. pt2go.co, and my email is jessica@pt2go.co as well. I do my absolute best to try and get back to folks same day, next day. And then we just launched yesterday the world's first concussion education program for clinicians that's multidisciplinary in nature, that's post-professional in nature, and year-long. So what we're finding in the literature is that entry-level education, we're not getting adequate, if any, concussion education at entry level across all disciplines. So there was a great article, I'll shoot you guys in the show notes as well, from the Physician in Sports Medicine, "Is Current Medical Education Adequately Preparing Future Physicians to Manage Concussion?" And the simple answer is no. And this was from, you know, Midwestern individual top 50 medical schools. So we're really all on the same level, and anyone that's saying anything different is either concussed or just, you know, just doesn't know. So it's completely post-professional, evidence-based, and I'm actually incorporating storytelling. So I have everyone from like pro athletes to grandma, providers and storytellers and caregivers storytelling their stories about their actual unfortunate mismanagement, with the healthcare community. So, my goal in life and profession now is to essentially tell these stories and give them some context and texture to clinicians. So the goal is to listen to these patients and caregivers that have gone through this mismanagement process, so we do not repeat this behavior again, and that so we can care for our patients well. So I really look forward to putting the care back in healthcare.
Awesome. That's great. That's fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. I think maybe you should blog about that for my blog. Maybe I can do a part two to that blog post you wrote a couple years ago.
Yeah. No problem, Arson. I'm happy to do that for you.
All right.
In case that is cut out from the podcast, they can hear about that in the Beyond the Podcast Periscope of why we're laughing about that. But Jess, thank you so much for joining us again. Thanks for taking the time. It was an incredibly informative podcast, and I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Yeah, I appreciate the invite, guys. I really do. And, you know, your audience is so powerful, and you guys are doing such great work. So I really applaud and commend you, because, you know, you're doing great things.
Well, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jess.
Yeah, that means
that's
a lot.
That's definitely going to make the podcast.
Yeah, that's definitely making the podcast. Emphasis. That's like when Stu McGill told us we were like the best interviewers.
That's awesome. That's a good compliment.
Yeah, I played that on loop. That's my alarm clock. I wake up to that in the morning.
No, if that doesn't make you feel good, I'm not sure what does. So that's awesome.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Jess.
People ask her about it, but she's going to blame post-concussive syndrome.
Yeah.
Hope you enjoyed that episode and learned something. I know out of all the stuff that I hear about, all the people that I interview, especially in business, it's a lot of common topics you just learn more about. But concussions is a whole different beast with so much more research and so much more knowledge that needs to come together, because it's something that can really change people's lives. So I hope, if nothing else, it got your curiosity up about it, and it's something that keeps you learning more about it. Jess is an awesome resource, so please take her up on her offer to reach out to her and use her as a resource for learning more about concussions. As always, if you have any questions from us or for us, check us out at updocmedia.com. Feel free to tweet at us at Therapy Insiders, at the OMPT, or at JoeDPT on Twitter. And if you need marketing services, if you need business consulting, especially in the physical therapy world, if you like kind of the stuff that we've been talking about, we get a lot of emails and questions about it. Yes, we provide services, and especially if you're a clinic owner, we can take the digital marketing stuff off your hands, work together, and really help you reach a larger audience for a lot less with a lot better data and measurements. So that is also at updocmedia.com. Check that out. And thank you for listening. Thank you for the reviews on iTunes. We really, really appreciate those. And if you listen to previous podcasts with Adam Meekins, when he criticized our music, on it. I am on it. We're going to have some new music coming up in the future, most likely crowdsourced and picked by you, the listeners. Coming soon.